Accession number 20482, Reel 3.
Acton, Reel 3.
On this Friday Wild, I was able to see my brother in Colombo, who I hadn't seen since 1939, so that was very good, and then back again to Trincomalee. We didn't stay very long in Ceylon. We completed this bit of training. We had one other useful thing about Ceylon, was we were on the coast and able to get sea bathing, and the sea bathing did very much to cure prickly heat, which so many of us suffered from prickly heat, a most distressing and nasty complaint. It really, the only proper way to get rid of prickly heat is to go to a cold climate again. However, Ceylon did it a lot of good. And then we went back from Ceylon and we went to Madras and we embarked in LSI, I think they were. But I remember that the vessel that 44 Commando were in had been a hospital ship at one time. Dunera was the name of the vessel. She was transporting us anyway across, and this was a much better way of going across the Bay of Bengal than going by the usual sort of troops movements. Anyway, we went then to Chittagong. Chittagong is a port in East Bengal, and it doesn't have a very good name, certainly not amongst serving soldiers, because it was a dirty place, very, very hot and very, very sticky. So we started off the movement from Chittagong to get down to the Naff River again, as we'd done this before. And it was the same sort of way, by lorries and Z-lighters, and we went to a place net this time, which was a bit further south on the Naff Peninsula than where we'd been when we mounted the operation for Alethang Yor, and the place was called Teknaf. And we were fortunate. We were able to build quite a good camp, and we had tents and so on, and it was very pleasant, Teknaf. And because I'd been trained as a messing officer, I got landed for doing messing work for the commando, and we built a very good galley out of 45-gallon steel barrels. We had a big boiler, which was an upright one, where you put a skin round the barrel and lots of clay, and we could fire this with a petrol pressure cooker. And then we also made a double oven of two 45-gallon steel barrels, which were laid horizontally, and we built up with old bits of scrap metal and clay a flue system round them, so we could either put a wood fire or these high pressure petrol cookers underneath to heat the ovens. So the chaps did very well then, and I always remember once we were told that we'd have some corned beef coming up and some salad that somebody got from somewhere. So knowing what corned beef was like in hot weather, where you open the tin and all the oil ran out and you pull the beef out in strands, we thought we'd try a trick. And we noticed further down the Teknaf Peninsula, a little way from our camp, there was a waterfall. So we took the whole consignment of corned beef and put it in the waterfall overnight. And we were able to bring it back. And I think we got away with what you would term sliced corned beef for the troops' lunch. we were told that we'd be in Teknaf for Christmas. This would be
44.
Christmas 44, yes. And eventually our Christmas dinner arrived, which was baskets of live ducks. So we found a chap in the commando who'd had some experience of poultry. He was relieved of all other duties and made OC ducks, and everything was done to help him. So we'd had very few casualties. So eventually, when Christmas Day came, we were able to roast 172 ducks, I think the number was. And I remember it very well because it all started the night before, because you couldn't keep live poultry in that sort of climate for very long. So things were the ducks had to go as close to Christmas Day as possible. And then we started roasting these ducks at about, I suppose about 4:30 in the morning, something like that. Anyway, the troops had a very good Christmas. So that was Christmas in Teknov, and it was very soon after Christmas that we moved away from Teknov, and we'd mounted the operation then to go to Akyab to start with. Now, nobody seemed to know anything about Akyab, what was happening there, and we went there believing that we could be opposed in Akyab, but it so turned out that we weren't opposed in Akyab at all. We had a very quiet sort of landing and we went ashore. The only thing that we ever found in Akyab really were a few Japanese booby traps, jars of jam and this sort of thing, which had booby trap arrangements on them.
Did anybody succumb to those?
I don't think there were any casualties in the Akyab operation at all. So really Akyab was a bit of a damp squib. So we stayed on Akyab Island for a bit, and then the operation was mounted to go to the Maibon Peninsula. This was, again, the same principle of interrupting and upsetting the Japanese lines of communication. So a landing was planned in Maibon, and some beach reconnaissance work was done by a naval beach reconnaissance group that worked with us. And we had two sloops to shoot for us. They were RIN sloops. One was called the Barda and the other Jumna, very shallow draft vessels, 4-inch guns. And 44 Commando were to land, I think, fairly late in the operation. And at the time we came to land on the beach in Maibon, the tide had receded, and our beach reconnaissance boys hadn't realised that what was underneath the tide was thick, glutinous mud. So, in fact, we jumped out of landing craft into mud up to our armpits or above. Fortunately, there was no Japanese opposition at that time. The beach had been bombed before the landings took place, and the 1 and 42 commanders, I think it was, who led the operation, they had gone further up into the peninsula. But we had a most awful, appalling time, hours and hours and hours of flogging through this mud. And you can imagine what it was like for chaps who got £100 weight on them being ditched into that sort of mud. Anyway, we managed to have a bit of a clean-up when we did eventually get to the beach, and then we went on up the, following up the Maibon Peninsula. And it was then that I was told that I'd been promoted to captain. We were, of course, temporary people, temporary officers. I think the proper title was temporary lieutenant acting temporary captain. So I was still only the one officer in the troop. We didn't have anybody else with us. Anyway, we went on up the Maibon Peninsula, and we came across quite a few dead Japs that some of our Japs who preceded us had killed. Later on, they managed to get some Indian Sherman tanks ashore in Maibon. Quite how they did it, I don't know, but they did, and we did meet some of them. And we went a fair way up the Maibon Peninsula, And here again, my memory's a bit fuzzy wuzzy, but from Maibon, we mounted the operation to go to a place called Kangor, which was further inland from the Maibon Peninsula on a chong or river. And this Kangor was certainly a place of extreme importance to the Japanese communications in the Arakan. So we landed unopposed from landing craft on the side of this chong or river, and 44 commando, or there were various names given to various hills, features on this coast, on this bit of land that we'd landed on. One was known as Hill 170 because it was a 170 contour. And there was a hill beyond that, nearer the Japanese, called Pinna. And 44 commando were told to go and hold Pinna against the Japanese. So off we set, and of course, needless to say, the time of day was getting on a bit. So we got on to Pinna and we started digging in. My S troop was between the commando headquarters and I think it was C troop, a rifle troop of the same commando. And so we dug ourselves in. There certainly was no prospect of using mortars or machine guns at that time. So we made ourselves as slip trenches as best we could. Then when darkness came, the Japanese started to attack Pinna. And the Japanese method of night attack was always to try and make British troops or Indian troops or their enemies reveal themselves by either firing or by noise or something of the sort. So they used to come close to your position and start trying to taunt you into giving away your position. So the defense mechanism for this, of course, was to use grenades. So we did. We threw a lot of grenades and things at these shouting and screaming Japanese, and then some of them were wounded, and that started all sorts of screaming and yelling. And then they started to retaliate with grenades and so on. And unfortunately, there was one of my chaps in a slip trench fairly close to where I was. He was a driver mechanic by trade, so he would have been really an ammunition number for machine guns or mortars. And I think he got a grenade in the slip trench he was in. Anyway, his foot was blown off. This was in the middle of the night, and he was bleeding rather badly. So the troop sergeant major, who at that time was a chap called Colonel Sergeant Mackenzie, went to him, and I went to along the top of the hill to commando headquarters to get hold of the doc. And we had an RAMC man with us who also went to the slip trench, and we managed to get the doc. Now, he was a marvellous chap, this doc. His surname wasn't James, but he was his name was James. Anyway, he came with lots of bottles of plasma and stuff, and he started on this chap, and he was absolutely marvellous. He got a drip going into him, and he to replace the lost fluid, and we were able to evacuate. Terrell, his name was George Terrell, the chap who was wounded. Now, during this operation, we had shooting for us the Nevada and the Jumna, the 2 4-inch sloops. And in the Nevada, there was a mobile surgical team of the RAMC. And funnily enough, one of the surgeons in that mobile surgical team had been our commando MO previously, before he went to the mobile surgical team. So I don't know whether Terrell got better treatment because of that or not, but he survived his wounds, and they were able to amputate his leg below the knee. So the business of having a false limb was very much improved for him. And he's dead now, unfortunately, but I saw him for years and years and years. I suppose the last time I saw Terrell would be about 1997, something like that. He used to come to the commander reunions, and he had a normal working life, very good indeed. So we managed to get him out, and this thing had gone on all night, and we'd had a lot of Japanese shelling as well, a lot of 75 and 105 millimeter guns firing at us. And we'd directed the fire from our RAN sloops against the Japanese as well. So anyway, it was decided that we should come off this hill pinner, because we'd had our old pasting. And so when daylight came, we did come off. And during the evacuation, I always remember this very well. A chap who was my MOA, Marine Officer's Attendant, they called him. The Army would call him a batman. A chap called Marine Hicks. No, Hicks, I think so, yes. He and I were at the bottom of this hill. I was sitting on one side, and he was sitting on the other side of a case of 3-inch mortar bombs. And the sloop, the RAN sloops were shooting for us, and I think it was the Jumna. She fired a salvo of 4 rounds. 3 went over the top of the hill, and 1 landed a foot from the 3-inch mortar bombs, which fortunately didn't go off. Otherwise, we would have probably been not here to record this for you. So we were moved back from this feature pinner onto Hill 170. And Hill 170 was a fairly long feature, and the Japanese were trying to get us off Hill 170. And we stayed on Hill 170, dug in with, I think it was mostly 42 Commander who were near us, for several hours only. And then it was decided that we would be taken off Hill 170 and we would go into reserve. And we went to a place just the other side of the river where we'd landed. But during the time on Hill 170, my troop suffered some more casualties, and we lost a chap called Morrison, who was a machine gunner who I'd trained originally in South Wales. A driver mechanic called Lewis, and 2 Marines called Walters and Shaw, who were all killed, unfortunately. So that was bad again for us. And we were able to bury these people. We had lost a chaplain on Hill 170 who was killed. Somebody else conducted the burial, another chaplain. Then this great big battle for 170 went on for a number of days after we'd left, and it was eventually held against any Japanese attack. There was 1 Victoria Cross won by a chap in 1 Commander, I think. But during our stay of Hill 170, there was a visit from the deputy brigade commander, Colonel Young, an army colonel, who I was telling you about on our drive from Banbury, and also the brigadier. Now, the brigadier at that time was a man called Campbell Hardy, who subsequently became the Commandant General Royal Marines. Now, I had known Campbell Hardy. He was the adjutant at Eastney in Portsmouth, but I didn't know him then. But he came as a chief instructor at the OCTU when I was there, So I'd known him, and he commanded 46th Commando in Northern Europe and came out to us when that was coming to an end. He achieved 3 DSOs and an accelerated promotion in less than a year. A brilliant soldier. He was a very fine man, Campbell Richard Hardy. So anyway, eventually we came away from the salient at Hill 170, and whatever was left of it became the army's responsibility. But by that time, the main salient coming down the Arakan had got down towards Kangor, and the Japanese had disappeared. But from the order of the day from General Christensen, which I showed you, you're able to appreciate that what we did was important to him, in that we certainly upset the Japanese line of communication to the Arakan very well, and supply and so on.
Well, had you been under Japanese ground attack on 170?
Yes, very much so. It was a very fierce, nasty attack. A lot of machine guns, mortars, a lot of artillery. The Japanese were very, very good with their artillery, very effective with their artillery. They got guns into most unusual places and used them very well. And the 105 is a nasty gun, and it's a big challenge. One doesn't like being shot at by 105s, but there you are. And by this time, we had some 25-pounder field battery of the Royal Artillery were shooting for us, as well as the two sloops. So we had a lot of covering fire.
What opinion did you form of the Japanese soldier?
The opinion I formed of the Japanese soldier, that he was a very good soldier, a very effective soldier. He could manage very well on very, very little. I don't think the average British soldier would manage anything like as well on with the same poor quality services and equipment as the Japanese did. Because by this time, the Japanese were very poorly supplied in Burma. The Burma campaign was coming to its logical conclusion, and they were not very well endowed with anything at all. They were living off the land. I think they were short of everything that you could think of, and we had plenty of air support. We had a lot of Harrier bombers flying for us, and I even remember when we were on Hill 170, there was a strategic airstrike of Liberator bombers came and bombed one of the hills that the Japanese were occupying. So, yes, the Japanese are a very good soldier, in my opinion. Anyway, after Hill 170, we went back into India, didn't we? Yes, that's right. And then we went to various places in India, and we went eventually to a place called Karakvasla, which is in Bombay Presidency, and there we started training for the operation to take Malaya. And we finished our training at Karakvasla and embarked in 2 LSI. They were the Glengyle and the Llanstefan Castle. I remember the Glengyle very well because I came across her in Malaya long after the war. And we set sail to mount this operation, and we got to Ceylon and Trincomalee, and we stayed there, and we found out the reason we'd stayed there was that they were dropping the first atom bomb. And the Japanese, after the atom bombs had been dropped, they surrendered. I think a signal came from a very much distressed Admiral Harcourt.
Carry on.
In Hong Kong, that he was desperate for help. He'd gone into Hong Kong with the East Indies fleet. This was before the British Pacific fleet came out of the Pacific into Hong Kong. And he only had the fleet marines and what sailors he could spare. And all the troops that were there were all airfield construction people, and they weren't trained soldiers at all. And they weren't trained soldiers at all, so he was desperate to have some reinforcement, and I think that this was what caused us to be routed up to Hong Kong. And this was probably the best thing that happened to us during the whole of the war, was to go into Hong Kong. We went into Hong Kong in August 1945, and at that time it was a sort of shooting match. The Japanese had locked themselves up in the prisoner of war camps and let all the prisoner of wars and internees out, and of course they were not in either a physical state or sufficient numbers to run an administration and look after the place, so looting was rife, and at night it was sniping and shooting all over the place. So the main task we had was to sort this out. And 44 Commando were on the Kowloon side, and we were some very good chaps who of the Hong Kong police had been interned but volunteered to remain to help clear up. And of course their knowledge and their informants and so on still existed, and it was very, very good. So we worked in very close cooperation with them, cleaning up all this weapon business. The main thing was to get the weapons in, so that we stopped all this fighting at night, because everybody was trying to have a go at his adversary that he hadn't been able to have a try at during the time of the Japanese occupation. So we did that for a time, and we were billeted in the headquarters of 44 Commando, because by this time I had ceased to have S Troop. I had been moved by the colonel, much to my annoyance, to become the commando administration officer. This meant feeding and pay and so on. So the headquarters of the commando, which I was a part, was billeted in a school in Kowloon. This was very good, and made a very good headquarters. And we had a little officer's mess in what had been a private house before, a bit further up the road. Then we had a task given to us to go and have do some work, mainly helping the local population on an island called Lantau, which is in fact bigger than Hong Kong Island, but lies off the coast. And so we had some troops there, and there were two little islands called Ping Chau and Chung Chau, I remember, where we had some small detachments under NCOs, which were close to Lantau. And so we had to supply Lantau. Our good doctor, James, again, the chap who tended my wounded so well, he recognised that the children on this island had been fed very, very poor diet, and there was very bad cases of wet beriberi and appalling vitamin deficiency type diseases. So every Marine was armed with masses of vitamin pills supplied by James, and wherever we went, the task was to make sure we put as many vitamins down children's throats as we possibly could. At that time on Lantau Island, funnily enough, we had a T-class submarine that used to come into Lantau. Their job was to assist the Navy in putting down local piracy. I mean, these junks were armed with really good automatic weapons. They weren't just the odd rifle here and there. They were really good, well-armed vessels. So they had to clean them up as well as the shoreside arms problem. And this T-class submarine came along. So we had a very good liaison with the wardroom of the T-class submarine. And we used to go aboard them. They used to come to our headquarters mess in Kowloon to very a sort of good recreational activity, if you like. our commando football team was a very good football team, and here we had this chap who got the bullet in his chest at the Alethang Yaw thing, came back to the commando, and